Good morning, my friends. Hope you're doing well. Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain, sometime in the fetid, smoky wilderness of mid-July 2026. Up here in the tinderbox known as Canada. Probably be doing a little something later today on the forest fires. The 100-plus forest fires raging across Canada. Some of the causes and reasons behind it, because, you know, Canada's got a pretty special relationship with summer, because it's one of the times you can, of course, go outside and you don't freeze your nads off. Instead, you feed mosquitoes with all of your descendants' lifeblood. But it's nice to be outside, a little tricky to be outside when it smells like a cyclops' tinder ass. So we'll be talking about that a little later today. So, yeah, I was thinking this morning about, I'm sorry if you haven't seen it, I'm not going to put any spoilers in, but with regards to the Odyssey, I was thinking this morning, like, I can't think of any other race or culture or ethnicity or group or religion as a whole that is continually hand-wringing itself over military victories. I can't see it in other cultures. Other cultures tend to have great respect for their military heroes, those who wring great victories. I mean, the Trojan War, we can, of course, say, and it's reasonable to say, was not a defensive war. It was not a necessary war. It was a war of vanity, and it was a war of jealousy, and it was a war of, in a sense, lust. The face that launched 1,000 ships, the most beautiful woman in the known universe, and so on. And it was a war of entangled alliances, in that the kings in Greece had all agreed to go and get Helen if she was taken. And it was a grinding slaughter fest that wore down between 50 or 100,000 or more of Greeks' prime. And of course, we think, oh, that's, you know, 50 to 100,000. Well, it's a big deal, though. It's a big deal. 50 to 100,000. So, you know, Greece only had a couple million people. Greece now only has 10 million people. So that's a lot, right? And that is a lot. That would be the equivalent of what? Somewhere between, let's see here, do the math. So somewhere between, it would be, you know, five to 10 million, perhaps, of. It would certainly be, yeah, three to 8 million Americans going off to war. And of course, how many of them came back? And those who came back, how many of them were marriage worthy? How many of them had assets? How many of them were wounded? And so on. So, you know, the decisions that are made at the top, you know, they say, oh, what we do echoes in eternity. But that's not true for most people. Most people come and go and barely leave the mildest skid mark on the tarmac of reality. They're just there to replicate their NPCs and do their manual labor and avoid self-knowledge and have no inner voice and contribute nothing and, you know, consume the most sloppy media and eject the most programmed opinions and, you know, barely raising their life from the intellectual level of a mudskipper. But what the people do at the top, what the people choose at the top, really does echo in eternity. And the decision to pursue Helen to Troy and to flex mighty military muscles and to send the strength and flower of Greek youth trained. It's tough to train people in a war like that. To train people in sword play, sword and shield play, spears, bows, and so on. To train people in those kinds of martial weaponry is way tougher than teaching them to shoot a machine gun. Way more skill. Way more skill. And so, All of the efforts, it has such a ripple impact on everything and everyone when you make a decision like that at the top. It teaches people, of course, that being a slave is safer than being a free citizen, because slaves were not sent to the war, right? Because you don't want to train your slaves on how to fight. And the people who bought the slaves don't want to give them up. And so being a slave is better. Being subjugated is better than being free, because being free means that you get yanked across the Aegean for a useless 10-year battle that was only ended by just about the most famous ruse in history, the Trojan horse, which was Ulysses' idea, of course. He was a cunning trickster. He was a brilliant man, known more for his wicked intelligence than for his martial power, which is why having Matt Damon slog his way across a washed-out Aegean for 20 years and become a drug addict, which is not in the source material, and so on. It just makes no sense. I mean, don't you have to really like the guy? I remember in Raging Bull, I see Jake LaMotta, my Robert De Niro character, you know, is violent and abusive and scornful of anybody more attractive. And then there's the scene at the end where he's in jail, he ends up in jail, and he's just like punching the wall, incredibly frustrated with his own bad choices. I guess a bit of a character arc, right? One of the greatest character arcs is Hamlet, of course, or Macbeth is a downward character arc, where you're different at the end than at the beginning. And this is the idea that if you watch people make terrible decisions, then you get inoculated against those bad decisions yourself, right? There's an old movie, I think from the 80s or 90s, called Fatal Attraction, with Glenn Close and Michael Douglas. And I remember this was memorably called the movie that scared the pants onto American, you know, see, scared the pants onto American men, because it's about Michael Douglas, who made an entire career playing put upon white guys. And it was, oh yes, you can have wild, hot, sweaty monkey sex with an unstable woman, but then she gets pregnant, she becomes a stalker, and she boils your children's bunnies, and so on, right? And so there's a bad consequence, and so you say, okay, well, maybe I don't want to go down that path. And that's really one of the purposes of art, is to inoculate you against bad choices. And where's the character arc? Of course, in the original Odyssey, Odysseus is in part, it's his vanity that causes his problems, right? Because after his men blind the Cyclops, he can't resist telling the Cyclops that it is he, Odysseus, who blinded him, and know this and all of that. After he uses the fantastic word trick of saying, what is your name? My name is Nobody. Nobody's attacking me. Okay, you're fine. So, yeah, a joke that lasted 3,000 years, traveled 3,000 years to land in Christopher Nolan's film, found no friendly shores and couldn't land. Because Christopher Nolan doesn't do people. He does plot and depression. He doesn't do people. He doesn't do joy. He doesn't do humor. He doesn't do spark. He doesn't do wit or anything like that. And he's sort of fulfilled. What is he fulfilled? Was it his brother, the screenwriter, who gave him the line, either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain? Which is just one of these things that sounds deep, or it's not really deep. But it is actually, well, not deep. It is kind of true in Christopher Nolan's case. He's just another self-hating white dude who will sacrifice everything in the pursuit of fame and accolades and glory and so on. There's a reason. I mean, these days, there's a reason a movie gets made, at least by the studios, and it's because it's negative in general to the West, right? So the reason why Odysseus has such a tough time getting home, or one of the main reasons, is he blinds Poseidon's son and then tells Poseidon's son, hey, it's me, Odysseus, I did this to you, na-na-na-na-boo-boo. And then, of course, that's how Poseidon finds out who blinded his son, and that's why Poseidon prevents him from getting home for so long. And of course, you need that story. I'm sure, of course, Odysseus lived and he had a long time getting home. And you have to answer why a week to a week and a half's voyage took 20 years, well, or 10 years. I'm sure the tale grew in the telling. The Iliad and the Odyssey are only two. I think there's eight in total. We only have fragments of the others that detail the entire Trojan War. But the decision, just go to war. Go to war. Go to war. That's a decision that really does echo in eternity. The decision to go to war in World War I kind of doomed the West. Or the decision to, we're going to give the government control of the education of our children in order to preserve our culture and our values and our history and our way of life. And does it work? No. And we all have to live in the shadow of these decisions. It's a whole lot easier to go to war than to stop going to war. It's a whole lot easier to break someone's bone than it is to fix it. And some things can't be fixed. Right? You hack off someone's hand, you throw it in a blender, it ain't coming back. And the decision to go to war, it's going to be a grand adventure. They'll tell tales of a St. Crispin's Day. Yeah, just go to war. And then what happens? Well, we see, right? For over 2,000 years, Greece was then subjugated because going to war meant, genetically, mostly a dead end. If you're a slave, you survive. If you're a free man and a warrior, you die. Or you come back so haunted and traumatized that you're useless to your bloodline in many ways. It's the same thing happened, of course, after World War I. Easy to start. And by the end of it, the communists are in control of Russia. And you have millions of traumatized, broken people that are a massive burden on the state. You know, this is where the term shell shock came from, is they couldn't figure out why otherwise brave people couldn't function. It's because they had been exposed to so much lengthy stress. Stress is for, like, you get away from the bear 5-10 minutes. You're in a fight 5-10 minutes. You either win or you lose or you run. But you don't stay in a fight or run from a bear for 4 years straight or 3 years straight or 2 years straight. It just burns out your entire system. It's not what the human body's designed for at all. It's perpetual stress. Perpetual stress is one of the greatest killers of people and cultures and histories. So one of the basic virtues of the Odyssey, as it's portrayed, is don't brag. Don't brag. Don't brag. And it's kind of true. It's kind of true. The Tate brothers are inveterate braggarts, and they just got arrested, I think, was it Miami yesterday? On extradition requests from the British government that is piling up more and more tsunami-like charges against them. Just don't brag. Don't brag. Easy live, quiet die, be humble. Don't brag. Brag makes you a slave of status, and bragging generates hatred. So talking about your accomplishments is very encouraging to people of confidence, and it is enraging to people without confidence. Everything that we do is an interplay of intrasexual competition. If you brag too much as a man, the other men, recognizing the danger of hypergamy and that you could end up with a harem, or if you brag about, I'm so hot, I'm so this, I'm so that, so wealthy, well, other men resent you because you are, in a sense, broadcasting to the women and triggering their monkey branching and hypergamy, the hypergamy wanting to marry up. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous. It would be nice if it wasn't, in a way, I suppose, but if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. But what is the moral of the movie? In other words, what did Odysseus do wrong? In Hamlet, Hamlet sits as a midway point between the Dark Ages and the Enlightenment, in that I would certainly hope that if I knew someone who said, a ghost has told me to kill a guy, that we would get him checked out medically, that we would have him evaluated, that we'd check his brain, his hormone levels, see if there was a tumor or something that was really affecting his mindset. I would want to do that because I don't think that we should say, a ghost told me to kill a guy. So I would go kill a guy. Well, that's not the way to live, right? That's not. So Hamlet has a vision. Now, of course, it's made more dramatic by other people can see the vision and so on. But if you're the prince and you say, I saw a ghost, other people who are subordinate to you will say, okay. Or sure, I think I saw something too. Like, they're not going to contradict the prince, right? Because he's going to be the king. He's a very powerful guy. So the idea that hallucinations, psychoses, visions are not true. They're not true in an empirical sense. Hamlet's father did not come back from the dead to tell him about hell and to murder his uncle. That's not a factual thing that happened. He dreamt, he had a vision, he has psychosis, he has schizophrenia, he has a lot of people hallucinate. A lot of people hallucinate. People who have epilepsy, then they've been able to do this. They can simulate religious visions in people just by stimulating a particular portion of their brain. They get cascading angels, they get bliss, they get trumpets, they get amazing stuff. And the humility of saying, look, we have an entire generative area of our brain. We have a part of our brain that can 150% manufacture reality. I don't know if you ever had those dreams that are more vivid than your waking life. I remember when I was going through therapy and just this massive life change where everything in my life changed. I had these incredible dreams that were so vivid and detailed. It wasn't lucid dreaming, because lucid dreaming is when you can sort of control the outcome. But it was super reality. It was, I was flying over a city and I could see every hair on everyone's head. I could see every Rantian bottle cap ground into the tarmac. I could see every piece of gravel around every air conditioner on the top of every apartment building or office building. I could see everything. And all at once. Like normally you look at something, you see that, but everything else is peripheral vision. It's kind of a blur. I could see it all. And of course, if I was not self-knowledgeable or had respect for my inner life, I would say, I touched upon a real reality. I touched upon a higher reality. I went to another dimension where things are more. It's like, no, I didn't. I didn't. I had a hyper vivid dream. And that was a more dramatic one. Another one, I opened a hotel door. I was actually staying in a hotel on business, and I opened the hotel door in my dream. And all I did was stand in the doorway of the hotel, door right opened, and I looked across the hallway, and I could see every little fiber and divot and bump on the wallpaper, everything. Like I was zoomed in, but I wasn't zoomed in. I could absorb it all. So that tells me how incredible the generative aspect of the mind is. It's incredible. I had a dream, and a dream this morning that I was in a giant library and a T-Rex and I were kind of playing cat and mouse. And I think I know what it's about. Doesn't really matter. But I mean, that's amazing. So the brain has these incredible generative abilities. It can make the unreal seem real. And it does that at night. And is it impossible for that to overwhelm the senses and to do that in daytime? Well, we know for a fact that it is, because there's something called psychosis, schizophrenia, hallucinations, both auditory and visual, and both. And it feels real to people. And taking sort of core central dysfunction in the brain and trying to move that to the realm of metaphysics is to make madness real. To make madness real. For the blind man to assume that there is now no such thing as light, that there's no such thing as vision, that everyone who says that they can see is just kind of lying. Well, it's a dysfunction, deficiency of the eyes. So in the Odyssey, there's no character arc. How is he different at the end than at the beginning? Well, he's reunited and so on. But he's just miserable. He's just miserable. And that, of course, is, if you were to do the Odyssey for real, it would be wildly foreign to the post-Christian mind. To the post-Christian mind. And, I mean, Nietzsche talked about this quite a bit. Christianity is opposed to the conquering tribal warrior spirit. And there is a depressed or depressive and masochistic element to the Christian worldview. Satan runs the world, your body is largely your enemy, and your hero was overpowered and destroyed. You don't have a hero who conquers. All you can say is, he died, but he conquered death. Okay, he conquered death. I mean, if you're in a duel and the guy shoots himself, you've kind of won the duel, right? And this is why Christianity just cannot hang on to countries. I posted this whole list. It was a list of like a dozen countries and dozen regions that Christianity just has lost out to. There's a kind of dreamy focus on the other world, on the world to come, that all of this is a passing bit of minor testing nonsense. And the real purpose of life is death. That life is a brief, unimportant test for the eternity of the afterlife. And as a friend of mine said, Christian, years ago, unfortunately, Christians, we're at our best when we're being persecuted. And that's going to mean that persecution is going to some degree be the goal. If you were to portray the world of ancient Greece accurately, it would be incomprehensible to the Christian mind. Incomprehensible. Because the idea that Ulysses would feel catastrophic guilt at his brilliant military victory is incomprehensible in the ancient world. He took a 10-year stalemate and ended it with one of the most brilliant strategies in all of military history. And he won. He triumphed. He's now famous for eternity as one of the most brilliant military minds in all of human history. And he gets to go home. He gets to go home. I mean, you're now a famous general. You're a hero. In your culture, songs, a song about you. You will be famous forever. You've won the battle. You get to go home to your beloved wife. The idea that he would just be pouty, negative, and stung with guilt. I mean, the takeover of India was one of the most brutal things that has ever happened in human history. I've not seen a lot of art coming out of that that is highly negative. I mean, Japan had this long martial history, right? You've seen those memes of like the Japanese warrior. There's the three stages of Japan, like the Japanese warrior, and then Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and then this goofy anime boy band stuff. And look, I'm not an expert in Japanese artistic history or anything like that, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and going to assume that there was not a lot of self-flagellation over their military victories in the past. I mean, as I've mentioned a bunch of times, Genghis Khan is praised and considered a wonderful figure by the Mongolians. How many cultures self-flagellate over brilliant military victories? So famous that we're talking about the military victory 3,000 years later. I mean, how many things the people did from 3,000 years ago we're still talking about now? Stuff's been lost, Library of Alexandria. I get all of that. But the idea that you are a warrior and you fight a tough battle and then you win and then you're racked with guilt is incomprehensible to the ancient world. Incomprehensible. And of course, one of the problems is that Odysseus didn't write the Odyssey, right? I mean, Homer, bunch of people, blah, 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 right? And so another problem, of course, is that the artistic mind and the military mind are in many ways opposites. The military mind conquers the world, the artistic mind explores the mind. The military mind goes out and dominates empirical reality with little thought to internal stimuli. Embrace the suck, right? That's what they say in the army, right? Things are bad. Embrace the suck. And I've worked with a bunch of military guys over the course of my career, and they're just very different. They're very very impatient, very blunt, very mechanical, no particular inner lives. And this is not a criticism. It takes all kinds, right? And without the military mind, there's really not much of anything because you just get conquered, enslaved, and killed. But the artistic mind, which is about the exploration of inner stimuli and imagination, and there is no empiricism to the artistic mind. Like, I mean, there can't be. There can't be, because, I mean, if you're writing a work of fiction, and I've written many novels myself, so you have to abandon yourself to pure imagination, and you have to imagine people who don't exist and write down things they never said. I mean, you want to make it realistic, of course, and there's cause and effect and so on, and you want the characters to be consistent, but the military mind is empirical. The army marches on its stomach. If you don't have the ammo, you lose. And victory or loss in the military world is usually life or death. So you can't afford to be dreamy, daydreamy. You can't afford to indulge in your imagination, which is one of the wild things about Odysseus, which is that he comes up with the Trojan horse, right? Incredible act of imagination, which is why he was so unusual. So the military mind is empirical, other-focused, outward-focused, practical, impatient with abstractions, and certainly impatient with imagination and daydreaming, which is why most of the innovation in the military comes from outside the military. And the artistic mind is very much focused on inner stimuli and is anti-empirical. In fact, it's so anti-empirical that in the modern world, you know, you see all these, this is a work of imagination. Any coincidence of real people is purely coincidental. Like they have to be so anti-empirical that you really can't base your characters on anyone identifiable, because then you might get in trouble, right? So you have to be very anti-empirical. And so when you have creative people trying to talk about the mind of a military person, and creative people create and military people destroy, right? It's an old saying about the army. What's the army for? Killing people and breaking things. And it's true. And this is another problem in the communication of military matters from creative artistic people, is that you have to avoid the narcissism of saying to yourself, as a writer, as a creator, you have to avoid the narcissism of saying, well, how would I feel if I caused the sack of a city and the destruction of countless people? How would I feel as a sensitive, creative person who's anti-empirical? How would I feel if I had unleashed hell in a city? So, of course, Christopher Nolan would not have been, he would not have been among the Greeks who went to Troy. He would not have been there. There was an actress, there was a World War II film called Mrs. Miniver. And the actress said, oh, I want to go drive an ambulance. I want to do something for the war effort. And everyone just kind of laughed at her and said, listen, you make these great movies that inspire people to do well under war conditions. So you trust me, what you're doing is great. So Christopher Nolan, I'm not reading his mind, right? But this is just sort of the evidence stuff, right? It could be any artist. I'm not sort of trying to pick on him. Christopher Nolan injects the creative mind into the journey of the warrior. And the journey of the warrior occurs because Odysseus is not Christopher Nolan. He's not a creative, dreamy. I mean, Christopher Nolan works hard, of course, right? I think he said he's going to take 3 years off from making movies because this one just about broke him. Hey, it's tough applying depressed, washed out filters to the beauty of the Aegean. That's not easy, man. No, make it darker, make it more depressing. And so the journey of the military mind is the journey of practicality, of anger, of the will to dominate, of empiricism, and not of daydreamy, anti-empirical imagination, which is what fuels the artist. So Christopher Nolan cannot resist saying, well, if I had caused the pillaging of Troy, I would feel bad because I'm an artist and I'm creative and I'm sensitive. And yeah, nothing wrong with being creative and sensitive. I'm pretty sensitive, pretty creative, but there's nothing wrong with it. Sorry. Make it sound like there's nothing wrong with it because I have those characteristics. I mean, obviously, there's nothing wrong. You need your artists and you need your warriors. I'm sort of trying to point out that one of the problems with how warriors are portrayed in art is that artists are the opposite of warriors, for the most part. For the most part. For the most part. And so you've got the artist who has to imagine the mind of a warrior. And artists are W.O. warriors, not W.A. warriors. And so Christopher Nolan says, oh, man, I mean, let me try and get into the mind of Odysseus. Let me try and get into his mind. Okay, so man, if I had caused the sack of Troy, I'd feel terrible. I mean, if I'd sourced, I mean, there's this Athena is like the girl killed, which is not a real thing, right? A young, beautiful girl would not be killed by a pillaging army. I mean, she would be taken as a concubine, right? Or as a slave, but she would not be killed, right? So that, I mean, except by accident, but this was very willful and deliberate, right? So the artist looks at Odysseus and says, ah, and what does he do, right? So he has the Trojan horse, and he's keen and he's eager. This is going to end the war. This is a wild stab in the dark. This is like the most crazy military maneuver that has ever been attempted in all of history, and it kind of is, right? And so he's desperate to end the war. And of course, he's seen the Trojans kill his soldier mates for 10 years straight. So bro's got some anger. Bro's got some rage. And his will to dominate is so great that he comes up with the Trojan horse and goes inside. And it is almost certainly a suicide mission. Almost certainly a suicide mission. There's a bit in the Odyssey, the movie, where they're sticking swords in to make sure there's no one inside. And that to me makes no sense. If you think there's people inside, then you would feel all around it. You know, there's a giving birth thing, right? The sort of the trap door in the bottom and the belly of the horse and so on, right? So you would check for that. Oh, look, there's a trap door here. Oh, wow. Okay. You know, and they would listen. They would, you know, people got to pee, they got to poop, you know, whatever it is, right? They sweat, they drip, right? So again, we don't know the actual, obviously, the story, but it's not particularly realistic that they think there might be people in there, but then they just don't really. I mean, they had to have air to breathe, right? They had to have air to breathe, which means that there's, you can look in, right? So you hold up your torch and you look in, and right? So anyway, we'll just go with it. So it's almost certainly a suicide mission. For some reason, it is. I mean, they're so relieved because they think the Greeks have left. Why there's a Trojan horse there doesn't really make much sense. But anyway, so it's almost certainly a suicide mission. He's absolutely keen, and he pulls off just about the most brilliant military victory, which is what he's been trying to do for 10 years. Now, of course, he's a warrior, so he knows that there's going to be a pillaging and sacking of Troy. He knows that his men are going to, you know, do what the communists did when they rolled into Germany at the end of the Second World War. Like, grape, pillage, loot, riot, steal, stab, right? They're going to do what victorious armies have always done. This is not going to be a shock to him. It's not going to be a shock to him. It's like a coach who's leading a team to victory, and then they win the World Cup, and he's shocked that they're celebrating. It's like, what? It just makes him look ridiculous. And so the journey of Odysseus to Troy is the journey of the warrior. And then when he achieves his victory, suddenly he becomes Christopher Nolan. And this is the narcissism and vanity that artists have to resist if they wish to be accurate, if they wish to be honest. So it's the military mind that gets the Trojan horse inside the city. And then what happens? Well, there's a bit of fighting from Odysseus. And then what happens is he just sits on the steps and stares. And he's sad. No, no, no. That's not Odysseus. That's not Odysseus. That's Christopher Nolan. That's suddenly the artist unable to empathize with the victory drive of the warrior. He's so passionate about this war that Odysseus is so passionate about this war that he threatens to kill anyone who abandons their post and sails for home. That's how much he wants to win. So then, in his victory, the artist, the writer, the director, Christopher Nolan, cannot sustain the military mind and instead becomes the artist. He possesses and invades the mind of Odysseus and turns it into Christopher Nolan, looking at all of this sadness and tragedy and looting and pillaging and victory, right? And the artist is sad, but the military man would not be. So then instead of vanity and braggadocio being the cause of Odysseus's 20-year journey back home, because he brags to the Cyclops, now it becomes, well, he's just guilty. He's guilty. He's guilty about his victory. And what does that do? Well, it tells to Western men that victory is bad. Victory makes you sad. Winning is losing. And that to triumph, when you have willed it, will produce depression, negativity, drug addiction, isolation, loneliness, and a 20-year journey of watching your beloved companions get picked off one by one and killed. Victory is loss, victory is loss, victory is loss. Triumph is sadness. Domination is depression. It's the cuckification and the emasculation of the Western warrior mind. And the West ain't doing too well. And this is partly why. This is partly why. And of course, the Christian mind would recoil at the image of Odysseus taking great joy and triumph at the vanquishing of his enemies. Now, of course, troops are supposed to have some kind of discipline when they win a lot of times, right? It's not like the Geneva Convention applied 3,000 years ago, but troops are supposed to have some discipline and not supposed to do all these terrible things and so on. And the military leaders will often try to, even for just practical reasons, restrain the bloodlust of their troops. So he could have done some of that. But the idea that Odysseus could take joyful triumph in the vanquishing of his enemies, like Conan style, right? To hear the lamentations of the women, right? That he could take, it's incomprehensible to the post-Christian mind. By post-Christian, I'm not just talking about like the fact that Christianity has diminished, but also post-infliction of Christianity, so to speak, on the West. It is a movie that programs Western males to give up, to lose, because winning makes you sad. Triumph makes you sad. Just think of the tribes, right? The indigenous population of North America, you know, engaging as they did in various battles and conquests and murders and so on, right? I mean, maybe it's there, right? But if it's there, it's because it's the artistic mind inhabiting the mind of the military and saying, well, I would be sad if I did these things. But the military mind is not sad when it does these things. It's sad and unhappy when it doesn't do these things, because it means you lose. Were there lots of stories, and maybe I'll look this up, right? But were there lots of stories from cultures that emasculated their warriors by cursing them with depression if they won? If they won? And of course, deep within the mind, this is no criticism of femininity, but deep within the mind of the creative, daydreaming, artistic guy is the belief that he might just be a little girly, a little hyper-feminine, a little, you know, because he looks at the tall, striding, dominant, masculine warrior type, and there's a certain amount of envy, a certain amount of resentment, and this sort of intersexual competition between the artist and the warrior. The warrior triumphs and obviously will often not do nice things to the artist, unless the artist is purely in service of the warriors in terms of like the epic poems of conquest and victory and so on, right? And so when it comes to the cheerleader, right, to the attractive young females, the artists are also in battle with the warrior, just as the nerds are in battle with the quarterbacks. Who gets the hot females? I mean, the artists want the hot females and the warriors want the hot females. And the artists have this resentment, which has really come pouring out since the 70s and 80s, right? Which is the artists will always portray the jocks as dumb, as sexist, racist, violent, abusive, drunkards, thoughtless, idiots, right? Sort of revenge of the nerds. It's like a very real phenomenon. It's just intersexual competition. It's just intersexual competition. Most of modern art, particularly movies, but also in books, Most of modern art is the artist slandering the athlete, the warrior, the man of action, and saying, I mean, you can get, okay, he's got reflexes, he's got a Chad jaw, he's got great hair, he's got sports or martial skill. Okay, he's got all of that, but I'm the really nice, sensitive one. I'm the guy you should choose, hot cheerleader, because he's an idiot. And it's not true. I mean, it's not true. Elite athletes are very intelligent, and elite warriors are very intelligent. You can't be elite at anything without being very intelligent. And where are the artists who truly understand the mind of the warrior? Now, listen, I don't want to make this all about me. I don't even want to make this tangentially about me, but I really did work hard to understand the mind of the warrior when I wrote my novel, Almost, which is my one war novel, at least the one war novel that I still have. The other one is somewhere buried in my mother's apartment. So I really did try to understand the mind of the warrior and not project, well, how would I feel if blah, 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 right? Because artists are sensitive to feelings and warriors are only horrified by loss, by losing. And the warrior has to be the opposite of empathetic. He has to be blind loyal to his own side, and he has to completely dehumanize the enemy. All right, of course you can't. I mean, in order to conquer in a martial sense or even in a sports sense, you have to dehumanize the enemy because they want to win, you want to win, blah, blah, blah. And of course, when I was a little kid, I was like, I would go to all these sports movies and be like, yeah, but if, you know, we cheer for the red team, but if we were on the blue team side, we just cheer for the blue team. It doesn't really mean anything. It was like some big moral divide. I get all that. And so, yeah, that's true. That's true. And that's fine for universal ethics and all that kind of stuff. It's good for empathy. And that, again, it's part of the spice you need in society. But holy crap. I mean, if my mindset was dominant throughout most of human history, it would be dominant for about 5 minutes. Well, they want to win on the other side of the battle just as much as we want to win. We're all people. Bleh. Spear through the trachea, right? Respect for the martial mind. Respect for the martial mind. But it seems almost impossible for the artistic mind in the modern world to do anything other than rail against. And in the Odyssey, this is the movie again, right? So, I mean, there was an interview with a bunch of the people from the Odyssey. And Tom Holland, remember I was saying, like, he's too feminine, he's too young, he's too, you know, whatever, right? He's too immature. He plays these sort of Japanese boy band child characters. And there was this, and I actually asked my wife this yesterday, as I saw this interview, my jaw kind of dropped. She didn't hear the interview, but I turned to her and I said, so Tom Holland has played Odysseus's son as 16. What's the problem with that? And she immediately shot back. It's like, well, he's gone for 20 years. He can't be 16. Right? Like instant, right? Because she's very smart, right? So so the other actors are pointing out to Tom Holland, hey, but you can't have been 16, because he said he was playing the kid at 16. He said, you can't be 16 because Odysseus has gone for 20 years and you were like 2 when he left. It makes you at least 22. Now, the difference between 16 and 22 for a male is like night and day. Night and day. And Tom Holland was just blinking and he's like, oh, did I make a huge mistake? Did I play this guy as 16 when he's in fact 22? I mean, we all, as a male and as a female too, right? You all feel that huge difference, right? And that tells you an enormous amount. I mean, if I've been a director, obviously, you know, completely minor relative to someone like Christopher Nolan, but I've directed a couple of plays that I've written. And you have to have long and deep conversations with the actress. And the actress have to know, you know, how old is the character? What's his backstory? You know, where's he coming from? I mean, when I would direct a play, if someone comes into a room, I would ask them, where did you just come from? Right? And when the character leaves the room, why are you leaving? Where are you going? Right? Because you have to believe there's something outside the stage in order to believe there are things inside the stage. Like if you just walk out and despawn like some NPC character in a video game, well, it's not very realistic. You have to be coming from somewhere and you have to be going to somewhere. And you have to know, right, something, or where did your character grow up and what's his relationship with his parents? Like you have to have this sort of richness in a character. So this means that they spent years planning and filming and quarter of a billion dollars making And the director never had a conversation about how old a pivotal character was. I mean, the story takes him in flashbacks from the age of 2 or so to the age of 22. So you kind of have to know what that arc is. Also, Tom Holland didn't think enough about the character to even work out the obvious basics of how old he was. 16 is very different from 22. Very different. Also, I don't think the Greeks did human sacrifice, so that whole story of the, was it Agamemnon killing his kid to get good weather, that's not a real thing, I think. I mean, I don't remember anything about human sacrifice in ancient Greece. Child sacrifice in particular, that's, again, a bit of a blood libel, but what the hell. So, it just tells you that they have not talked about the humanity of the characters. And it's all up to the actors, and actors are, in general, charismatic idiots. I have spent a lot of time around actors. I mean, I've trained with actors for almost 2 years, and I spent a lot of time around actors, and they generally are grinning, charismatic, deep-looking, but not deep. They're idiots, right? I mean, Matt Damon, I mean, obviously an intelligent guy, I think completely compromised by the powers that be, whatever, right? The Kavanaugh thing, the Kavanaugh jokes that he make on SNL are a stain on his character that will outlast anything else he's done if we have a even remotely moral future. But if you have the father and the son, and this is why the reuniting scene is so flat, right? Then they should be sitting down with each other as actors, just being responsible actors. They should be sitting down with each other and saying, okay, what's our relationship like? How much do you miss me? What have you thought about me? And so on, right? And part of that will be, okay, I've been gone for 20 years. So how old are you now? Okay, early 20s. Okay. Do you date? Do you, what do you do with your lusts? Are they subverted to some sort of other end? Like, you have to have these conversations to round out the characters and make them people. And just knowing this kind of stuff, you know, I remember reading the autobiography of Laurence Olivier, famous British actor from last century. And he said, like, oh, imagine you play a character where he's just shaved off his mustache and he keeps touching his upper lip because of that. Wouldn't that be fascinating? Okay, it's a little detail, it's a little interesting thing. And on the waterfront, like Marlon Brando is distracted by things that aren't in the scene, as you kind of are, right? And that just makes it very real, very spontaneous. There's a scene on a swing set where he takes the woman's, she dropped her glove accidentally in the scene. He picked it up, put it on, played with it, and she kept trying to want it back. It's very real because it wasn't acted, right? So it just means that in this $250 million production, nobody had any conversations about how old one of the central characters was and got it completely wrong. Like wrong by 20-25%. From child to man. Tom Holland played the character as a child when the character is in fact a full-grown man. Astonishing. And this was the lack of connectivity, the lack of relationships, because Christopher Nolan doesn't do relationships. He's not related to the characters. He's related to the technology. And of course, the reason why the movie is funded is it pushes for the endless inclusion of outsiders, which is, you know, kind of a thing in the West these days, right? So it's tough to watch. Now, listen, of course, look, I've just got to, obviously, maybe it's an elephant in the room. It's like, oh, well, if you know so much, why are you doing a podcast and not out there directing movies? It's like, yeah, it's a perfectly valid question. Absolutely valid and perfect question, right? That I'm just sniping from the outside and, you know, if I'm so smart, you know, like the guy in the diner who's like, I can solve all the world's problems. It's like, well, then why are you just some guy in a diner? Like, why am I doing podcasting? I have written, I believe they're going to be viewed in the future as really great books, and I think they're great books right now. So I have certainly put my theories into practice as an artist, and I've tried to make sure that I do not view those different from my mindset, not from a moral standpoint. I do not view those as different from my mindset as lesser. I always try to say, okay, but I happen to be, you know, creative, intelligent, blah 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 blah, and so on. Therefore, those are the good. And then people who are not creative are the bad. And it's like, nope, that's not it at all. You know, the guys who built my house aren't writing novels. But if they weren't building my house, I wouldn't be able to write novels because I'd have no place to live, right? So it's the scattershot of how human personalities are formed. It's all essential. It's all important. It's all necessary. So I try to not say, I am the template of that which is good and noble and perfect and right, and therefore everyone who deviates is somehow lesser. And it's like, no, respect for the people who run the sewage system, man. It would be pretty tough to live without a sewage system. I mean, I've done it working up north and in various primitive primordial cottages in northern Ontario and other places. So yeah, it's pretty tough to live without. If you've ever had to boil your own water to get something to drink, then you know that having taps and plumbing and all these kinds of things, and those people don't tend to write books and they don't tend to do philosophy and they don't tend to solve the problem of secular ethics and so on, but they're as essential to the functioning of human civilization, certainly in the short run, maybe a little bit more me in the long run as anything else. So I've always tried to have that respect for personality differences. And of course, having communicated with thousands of people about the inner parts of their lives over the years, when their mindsets are very different from mine. You know, I released a show recently with a guy who claimed he was autistic. And I've had a number of people talk about being autistic in my call-in shows over the years. A very different mindset from mine, but I really try to meet them where they are without the sort of good, bad judgment to take accidental personal attributes and say that these are somehow the universal good and everyone else is deficient and so on. And it's tough, you know? I mean, in the Odyssey, without the vanity of taunting the gods, how does Christopher Nolan explain why it takes this Odysseus so long to get home? I mean, there is the bit about the gods and Poseidon and the storms and this, that, and the other, and I get all of that. But why does it take him so long to get home? Well, he faces genuine physical obstacles, right? The winds are always against him. There's all these storms. He gets blown off course. There's Scylla, there's Charybdis, there's Circe, there's the giant Cylon, as James memorably referred to them as, not the hot ones. So, I mean, he faces genuine external threats. But then it turns out, well, he's just kind of guilty as well. And maybe that's why he becomes a drug addict, spends 7 years on the island with the hot South African with laser blue eyes. So, I don't know, man. So is it an outer resistance, but he really wants to get home, which makes it a tragedy? Or is it inner guilt? He becomes a drug addict, which makes it pathos. It's not a tragedy if you get what you want and you're really unhappy about it. So he went, like, how does that work? You get what you want, but you strive for 10 years to achieve. You finally get what you want and it makes you miserable. I mean, maybe that's, maybe Christopher Nolan's battling depression, though he's a very celebrated filmmaker, right? Maybe, I don't know. But you get everything you want and that makes you miserable. That's a way to program people to not strive, to not be ambitious. I mean, just for myself, I have gotten what I want out of life. I've got a great family, got great friends, an incredibly meaningful occupation, and doing good in the world and all of that. How can I get what I work for and get what I want and be miserable? That's kind of incomprehensible to me. Now, of course, some people get what they want and they're miserable, like I want to win the lottery, and then they end up in a shallow, empty life of being exploited and everybody wants them for their money. So I get all of that. But I mean, I have, you know, some pretty decent moral goals and so on, right? So how can you get what you want and be miserable? It's just a way of programming people to not try and achieve anything. Oh, you're depressed now, but boy, wait until you achieve a massive victory that will resound down through the ages. Boy, then you'll be miserable. Yeah. So this is, it's a collision of sort of Christian guilt with ancient warrior spirit, and it just drains the vitality out of the whole film. Nobody has any fun. Everybody's sad. Everybody's depressed. Everybody's depressed. And then if Odysseus is depressed when he comes home, then his wife is not going to be enjoying his company that much, because it's pretty tough to enjoy the company of depressed people. So that means this big reuniting, this big get back to your family, which drives the whole movie, doesn't really mean much. Hey, the broken shell of the man who went away has returned, and now I get to nurse his depression for the rest of time. Blech. Anyway, so I hope that makes sense. I really do. Sorry for the people who came and went. I was on a bit of a roll there, and I hope that you find the conversation to be of value. But yeah, think about it. Think about the people who are very different from you, not in a moral sense, but people who are just very different from you. I mean, I spent 6 months in a tent with two guys who were just very practical, externally driven guy. I spent 6 months in a tent with those guys and they smoked. And I got to really recognize just how different people's thinking is from me. I worked with a woman. We lived in the same apartment and we worked together. And she was a woman who was an Asian geologist and incredibly different. Like we try to have conversations. I live with this person, just had these incredibly different thoughts and perspectives and opinions. She had zero inner life and very outward focused and very practical and very hardworking and all of that. And just if you haven't really, you know, so to speak, rubbed noses with the people who are very different from you and learned how the value of what they have to offer, it's really tough to do good art. All right. Have yourselves a beautiful day, everyone. Don't forget call.freedomain.com. Call.freedomain.com. Set up your call-in shows. Got a couple today. And I've got some space next week, so I hope you'll set up some call-in shows. Freedomain.com/donate to help out the most unique and powerful conversation in the world. For all time, I think. I think it's what I aim for every time I open my yapper. So freedomain.com/donate to help out the show. Hope you have a wonderful, wonderful day. We'll talk to you soon. Bye.